Welcome to Dead Souls Social Club.
If you enjoy our show and you find our research interesting, please leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform. Something that small really does go a long way in helping us out. You can find more about us and the research that we do by heading over to Instagram and searching our name. As always, thank you so much for joining us tonight. When I discussed wanting to put an episode together about tonight's subject with my team, they looked at me like I had two heads. I can understand that entirely. Both of the people who contribute to this show are all scientifically trained at university level, so I can appreciate their analytical and factual viewpoints. But let's be honest here, this isn't our first rodeo into fringe subjects. But for the most part, this does mean that I'm riding solo with tonight's episode. Tonight we are going to delve into the world of precognition. Officially, the definition of precognition is the phenomenon of psychical seeing, also known as being able to predict future events. Many people have been well known throughout history as being able to see future events, such as Edgar Cayce, Uri Geller, George King, Daniel Douglas Home, and of course Nostradamus. These individuals and many others who claim to have these abilities may also claim to be able to speak with the dead, amongst other paranormal mind powers that they have either developed or claim to have been born with. Whilst I appreciate that opinions are mixed regarding some of these individuals and also the powers that they claim to possess, there are also many people out there that firmly believe in this phenomena and those that practice it. A United States survey of the beliefs of the general population in 2005, conducted by the Gallup Organization, found that 41% of people believed in extrasensory perception, precognition, and psychic mediums. A further 26% believed in clairvoyance and telepathy. A similar YouGov poll in the United Kingdom in 2011 found that 24% of the British public believe in psychic powers, precognition, and telepathy. Make no mistake that there is no widely accepted scientific evidence that support the existence of precognition, a real effect phenomena. In fact, in the scientific community, it is widely considered to be pseudoscience. Precognition, in theory, would directly violate the principles of causality, or that an effect or outcome cannot occur prior to its cause. But that said, science and all the proven or observed laws of physics can also not disprove the phenomena exists. There has been a wide belief and interest in precognition throughout history. Although many religions lean toward it being a heretic phenomena or product of witchcraft. As I stated, despite there being no current scientific evidence to support the phenomenon's existence, though many people believe it to be real and it is still widely reported, studied and researched with ongoing debate and discussion throughout the parapsychology community. For a phenomenon that scientists will completely dismiss, there is an awful lot of reputable research facilities, laboratories and institutions that invest time, money and respected expertise in investigation into the subject. With the accepted scientific viewpoint being that we only know a small fraction of information about the human brain's capabilities and attributes, it seems premature to completely dismiss something that hasn't fully been examined and resulted in its entirety. What do you think? The first ongoing structured and documented research program into precognition was conducted by Joseph Banks Ryan and his wife Louisa E. Ryan in the 1930s. At Duke University's Parapsychology Laboratory. Duke University maintains a parapsychology research laboratory to this day. In 1969, Helmut Schmidt conducted precognition research at the Princeton Engineering Anomalies Lab. Schmidt was the first scientist to introduce REG, or random event generators, to experiment with the phenomena. Dr. Daryl Bem, a professor emeritus of parapsychology at Cornell University, published research findings showing statistical evidence for the existence of precognition in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Further research is currently conducted into precognition, another parapsychological phenomenon, at the University of Virginia, Department of Perpetual Studies, the University of Arizona, the University of California, Columbia University, and Duke University in the United States. Whereas in the United Kingdom, at the University of Northampton, the University of Edinburgh's Kessler Parapsychology Unit, and London's Goldsmith University. Research in the private sector, while also ongoing, is kept under more secretive conditions. The UK-based and world-renowned Independent Psychology for Psychical Research proposed five minimal criteria that needed to be met before an account of precognitive phenomenon could be verified and regarded as credible. Those five points are: number one, the dream or instance of precognition should be reported to a credible witness before the predicted event. Two, the time interval between the precognition and the event should be short. Three, the event should be widely considered as unexpected at the time of precognition. Four, the precognition description should be of an event destined to occur literally and not symbolically or metaphorically. 5. The details of precognition and event should tally accurately and down to small detail. These five parameters were introduced by the Society in 1965 and have since been accepted and considered to be the gold standard by scientists and researchers who investigate the phenomenon. Precognition is an example of the wider phenomenon of prescience of foreknowledge, essentially the ability to understand by internal cognitive means what is likely to happen in the future. It is distinct from a premonition, which is a vaguer feeling of some impending disaster or a non-specific concern of fear. Precognitive dreams are the most widely reported occurrences of the phenomenon. In July 2021, Stephen Taylor, PhD, published an article in the psychology journal Psychology Today. He shared a number of successful precognition experiments which had intriguing results. Taylor first shared a 2014 study of 10 participants who were tasked with predicting the movement of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. 7 trials were recorded, and the predictions were correct in all 7 of the trials, leading to a profit of $16,000. It has to be said that these weren't a random 10 individuals off the streets. They are part of a psychology program, and each member had shown previous positive results for precognitive outcomes. But Taylor also shared a further 2017 study of 15 participants, who again had previously shown some signs of psi ability. They were tasked with predicting the movement of the German stock market. 48 trials were conducted, and 38 of those were exactly correct. This amounted to a highly significant success rate of 79.16%. It's worth clarifying that these researchers decided not to use the study as an opportunity for financial profit, and they only invested tiny amounts of money for the purposes of experimental proof. Experiments and supporting stats and data are one thing, and they're all very well and good. But what about true life events, true life results? What about significant and evidenceable instances of true impact? On October 19, 1966, a man from Lancashire in the United Kingdom named Doug Weatherall had a dream that he was trying to purchase a book. In the dream, he was standing in front of an electronic machine with lots of switches and buttons, which had a small screen fixed into it. Weatherall described the machine like something out of NASA, or something from the future. Bear in mind that this was several decades before the personal computer became an everyday item for many. In the dream, Weatherall states he wasn't quite sure what the machine actually did. It was just stood there, as tall as me. He remembers the machine being outdoors, like on a grassy hill, further perplexing him as he had no idea how the machine was powered. Weatherall has stated that he wasn't much of a dreamer, and on the rare occasion when he did have a dream, they were fairly mundane in nature and nothing memorable. But this particular dream stood out to him. It was the most vivid and strangest thing that had ever come out of his subconscious. So much so that when he woke up in the morning after the dream, he wrote down what had happened and shared it with his wife and brother-in-law, who both agreed with him that it was strange, though nothing much else was thought of it at the time. What also occurred in the dream, after Doug had approached the machine with all the switches and buttons, was that the screen lit up. It was dark before, but it seemed to activate when he walked close towards it. On the screen, Weatherall could make out individual letters that appeared one by one across the center of the screen. A, B, E, R, F, A, N. After the last letter had appeared, the whole word flashed slowly. The word made absolutely no sense to him, and he didn't even think it was a word at all. It certainly didn't spell anything in the English language that he had heard of. Regardless, it all went over his head, and it was shared with his wife and brother-in-law, who seemingly shrugged it off. On October the 20th, 1966, a young Welsh boy named Paul Davis from a small village in Merthyr Tydfil drew a picture while in school. The picture was of people digging into a hillside with women gathered around crying. Above it, he wrote the words, "The End," in blood red lettering. Paul's teacher shared the picture with his mother, who found it quite strange. Paul didn't know why he had drawn it, other than to say, quote, "I just drew what I was thinking." You see, 2 weeks before, a girl named Eryl May Jones, who was from the same village as Davis, had randomly told her mother that she was, quote, "I'm okay and I'm not afraid to die." Comments then came out of nowhere and was something that made no sense at the time. Jones's mother asked why she said what she had said, and she replied that it was something that she just felt and she needed to tell her mother. On the same night that Paul Davis would have his own feelings of foreboding and dreams of death, Jones had a dream that she had gone to school only to discover that it was no longer there because, quote, "something black had come down all over it," unquote. Jones's mother, father, and church minister all wrote specific and detailed statements of what Eryl May said and had dreamed. All three would later log and write down in sworn legal documents to confirm what they had been told by Eryl May. The reason why Eryl May's dream and comments and Paul Davis's drawing and following dream were logged with supporting statements and taken so seriously was because the next day, on October the 21st, 1966, both children would be found dead. They would be buried underneath thousands of tons of coal slurry that had slid down the mountainside and engulfed their school during the Aberfan disaster in South Wales. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the heartbreaking and utterly tragic events surrounding the Aberfan disaster, it was the catastrophic collapse of a colliery spoil tip on the 21st of October 1966. The tip, essentially a huge mountain of dirt and rock that had been removed from local coal mines and dumped high up on a mountainside, had been created on a slope high above the Welsh village of Aberfan, near the town of Merthyr Tydfil in South Wales. What the workers who removed the dirt and muck and placed it atop the mountain didn't realise, or bother to check, was that the soil was placed over a natural spring. With heavy rain in the weeks prior to the disaster, a buildup of water within the tip from the spring below caused the huge tip to suddenly slide downhill as a wild slurry. Thousands of tons of soil, dirt and rock poured out of control down a hillside like a huge avalanche. When the slurry flowed into the village and in particular Pantclas Junior School for children aged 7 to 11, it killed 116 children and 28 adults. as well as the school, which was entirely destroyed in the flow. An entire street of houses was also wiped out. The first casualties arrived at St. Tydfil's Hospital in Merthyr Tydfil at 9:50 a.m. But by 11 a.m, just 70 minutes later, no further survivors would be found. The Aberfan disaster is one of the darkest and saddest moments in recent Welsh history, and as someone who grew up less than 10 miles away from the location of the tragedy, I know just how much this event still haunts the local community to this very day. But I'm not going to discuss or focus on this event too much tonight. If anything, the Aberfan catastrophe and surrounding events deserve an entire episode of their own. And maybe, if you guys want to hear it, I can look to put that episode together in the near future, in as respectful a way as possible, of course. Reach out and let me know if you'd like to hear that episode. But right now I'm focusing on those who knew, sensed, or even saw this event coming. As I mentioned, two of the children who died saw it, as did several others in a strange and bizarre series of circumstances. Reverend Glenant Jones, the minister of Saron Chapel in Aberaman, the village over the valley from Aberfan, was the minister for Eryl May Jones and her family. Though no relation, he stated in 1966 that, quote, "The day before the disaster, Eryl May said to her mother, 'Mummy, let me tell you about my dream last night.' Her mother answered gently, 'Darling, I have no time. Tell me again later.' But the child replied insistently, 'No, Mummy, you must listen. I dreamt I went to school and there was no school there. Something black had come down all over it.'" Unquote. The Reverend Glenant Jones was said to be extremely shaken up by this fact at the time. Just 13 months later, in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, in the United States, the Mothman sightings and their associated premonitions occurred, again, in a small mining town that would face its own disaster soon after. It would echo many of the same features as the Aberfan mining disaster. But what are the Mothman sightings? Well, let's first talk about the Silver Bridge. The Silver Bridge was a suspension bridge that had been constructed in 1928 to carry Route 35 over the Ohio River and to connect Point Pleasant, West Virginia, to Gallipolis in Ohio. On December the 15th, 1967, the Silver Bridge, or the Point Pleasant Bridge, depending on who you speak to, collapsed during heavy rush hour traffic. It was a horrific and tragic disaster which claimed the lives of 46 people. The bodies of two of those who perished, Kathy Byers and Maxine Turner, would never be found. But what does that have to do with a Mothman? Well, on November the 15th, 1966, Roger and Linda Scarberry and Steve and Mary Mallett, two young couples from Point Pleasant, had told police that they had been witness to a large black creature with eyes that glowed red. It resembled something that was half man and half moth in appearance. The creature had been seen standing at the side of the road near the site of a former wartime munitions plant. Linda Scarberry said it was about 7 feet tall, very muscular, and had white wings, whilst the rest of the creature was entirely black. The witnesses were incredibly distressed and left the area quickly out of fear. But they reported that the creature flew after their car, making a high-pitched screeching sound and pursuing them as far as the Point Pleasant city limits. Over the next few days, many more people in the town of Point Pleasant reported sightings of the same creature. In fact, there were over 100 sightings in the following 4 weeks. Two volunteer firemen who saw it said it looked like a huge bird with red eyes and a man's body. The Mason County Sheriff, George Johnson, dismissed the sightings as nothing more than people seeing a, quote, large heron in the area. A wildlife biologist at West Virginia University named Professor Robert L. Smith told the press at the time that descriptions and sightings sound like that of another bird, namely the sandhill crane, a large American crane almost as tall as a man with a 7-foot wingspan and reddish colouring around its eyes. Though the sandhill crane was not native to the area, and with many of the witnesses saying that it most certainly was not a bird. The body was entirely that of a muscular man, but with wings and glowing red eyes, like a demon, witnesses stated. Whilst there has never been an explanation for the Mothman, it's notable that the creature was only spotted around the time for a short period. The creature was not seen again after December 15, 1967, and this was the same date as the Silver Bridge collapse in the town. With many of the townsfolk crediting the Mothman sightings being somehow connected or a precognitive clue as to the bridge collapse. It's worth mentioning an interesting fact here. The coal seam that runs under Aberfan in South Wales is also the exact same coal seam that runs under Point Pleasant in West Virginia. Remember, they were both mining towns. The Aberfan disaster had a profound impact on John Barker. He was a psychiatrist who was working on a book called Scared to Death at the time. The idea behind the book was that hearing a premonition of one's death may result in deep fear, which could affect the body's immune system and lead to death, something he referred to as voodoo deaths. This concept, combined with the stories of foreboding that he had heard reported from Aberfan, led Barker to establish an organization named the Premonitions Bureau. It sounds like something out of a movie. But the Bureau wasn't as jazzy as the name suggests, however. They collected, catalogued and conducted research to verify predictions and precognitions before the catastrophic events that they predicted occurred. So it was entirely scientific and research-based. Although Barker did have a grand hope that his research could eventually lead to preventing such events, which may have been a stretch. Barker echoed a gentleman with a similar interest over in Point Pleasant, namely John Keel, a journalist and investigator who became obsessed with the Mothman event and eventually wrote a well-received book on the subject. Also, yes, Richard Gere plays him in that movie about him. Anyway, back to the Premonitions Bureau. They advertised in several national UK newspapers, stating that they were looking for anyone who had experienced a premonition of the Aberfan disaster prior to the event to get in contact with them. As it transpired, several hundred members of the public got in touch, and after some filtering of the applicants, they narrowed their focus to 67 individuals who they would maintain close contact with in order to collect premonitions. These 67 people demonstrated regularly consistent and a high success rate for making precognitive predictions, and the Bureau quickly began to amass numerous volumes of data. For instance, Alan Hensher, a telephone switchboard operator from Basingstoke in England, predicted on August 1st, 1985 that there would soon be a plane crash. The number 123 would be significant about the flight, but the fatalities would be around 520 people, he said. Just 11 days later, Japan Airlines Flight 123 crashed around 62 miles west of Tokyo. 15 crew members and 505 passengers would die in the disaster. 520 people overall. Whilst this could be considered a significant hit, the overall achievement rate of the Bureau was not so impressive on average. Of 723 predictions, which were logged during its years of operation, only 18 could be considered successful. Still, 18 is nothing to be sniffed at, especially when you consider that those 18 predictions in particular were incredibly detailed, and 12 of which were from just two individuals. The same two individuals having no misses with any of their precognitive predictions. Alan Hensher and Kathleen Lorna Middleton, who was a music teacher from London, who consistently foretold future events with uncanny precision. Middleton had sensed the Aberfan disaster because she awoke from her sleep on the day of the disaster with a horrible feeling of foreboding. She stated, quote, "I awoke choking and gasping for air, and with a sense that the walls were caving in," unquote. Middleton told her landlord, Alexander Baccianelli, about the feeling, and he offered to make her tea, something that she did not normally drink but which they took together. An hour later, Middleton and Bacchianelli heard the news of the disaster on the radio. In the autumn of 1967, both Henscher and Middleton began relaying predictions separately to the Premonitions Bureau. They were both relaying precognitive premonitions of a railway disaster on a train line leading into London. Neither Henscher nor Middleton were in communication with each other or knew of each other's existence. Yet they were reporting the same details at the same time. Middleton claimed to envision a crowd gathered on a railway platform with the words, quote, Charing Cross 49, coming to her mind. Tragically, just 4 days later, a passenger train from Hastings travelling to Charing Cross was derailed while heading to the station, resulting in the loss of 49 lives. All of these premonitions were recorded and timestamped before the events occurred. On April the 23rd, 1967, Middleton claimed to the Premonitions Bureau that she had a vision of a spaceman who was petrified, terrified, and frightened. The following day, the Soviet cosmonaut Vladimir Komarov died while returning from space. The death of Komarov was not known in the West due to Soviet secrecy, and the Western public did not hear the news until several months later. Additionally, and rather ominously, Middleton began to receive powerful images of Robert Kennedy in the spring of 1968. Quote, the word assassination continues to run through my mind. I cannot disconnect it from Robert Kennedy, unquote. Middleton said this to Barker on March the 11th, 1968. On June the 4th, Middleton frantically called the Premonitions Bureau three times about her increasingly strong visions and in a desperate attempt to save the young senator's life. Robert Kennedy died 2 days later, after being shot the day after Middleton's warnings. John Barker, who had founded the Premonitions Bureau, died of a brain hemorrhage on August the 18th, 1968, following which the Bureau was dissolved. Whilst the Bureau had sadly come to an end, Middleton still quietly conducted her precognitive efforts and logged her own premonitions over the years. Middleton didn't seek fame or fortune from her abilities, nor did she apply herself to be studied like a lab rat. In later life, through her dance academy, she befriended one of the older clients by the name of Christine McCarthy. McCarthy was in her mid-20s when they met in the 1980s, and by this point Middleton was well into her 70s. Whilst her dance tutorial days were long gone, she still liked to regularly visit the academy that she had founded in the 1960s. McCarthy and Middleton shared a bond, however, with McCarthy telling Middleton in confidence that she thought she was able to predict things much as Middleton had done before her. And in Middleton's final years, both her and McCarthy spent a huge amount of time together, sharing their skills and abilities, again, between the two of them, but not for financial gain, publicity, or celebrity. Throughout the 1990s and 2000s, McCarthy successfully, accurately, and with precise details, predicted the 1998 Omagh bombing by the IRA, the 1999 Ladbroke Grove rail crash, the London nail bombings in 1999, for which she shared valuable information with the Metropolitan Police, which turned out to be entirely accurate once the perpetrator, David Copeland, was apprehended, and the 2005 South Wales E. coli 0157 outbreak, in which one person died and 31 people were hospitalised. McCarthy, who is a care worker by profession and lives in Cardiff in South Wales, has logged around 400 precognitions over the last 35 years. She claims to have a success rate of around 68%, which means that of the 400 predictions that she has made, 272 are accurate predictions. So, all of these claims aside, I appreciate that a lot, if not the vast majority of the information here, is almost impossible to independently verify. We can't go back in time to guarantee that all the predictions were made before the events, after all. So despite its limitations, the Premonitions Bureau serves as a reminder, if nothing else, of a human desire to understand the unknown and to protect ourselves from the unpredictable. The research conducted by the Bureau was passed on to Cambridge University after Barker died, where all of the mysterious details can be accessed and read to this day. Barker was only 42 when he died, and one has to wonder how far into the mystery he might have gotten if he had been able to carry out the work for another decade or two. Research into precognitive events has always been a source of controversy, and I don't think that will change anytime soon. But I will end on this little story. You will recall that I said that Christine McCarthy now resides in Cardiff in South Wales. Well, yep, that's my home city. So I tracked her down and reached out to her in the hope that she might speak with me. McCarthy is now an active member of the Spiritualist National Union, although she is known by her married name these days. Whilst she declined the opportunity to be interviewed on the show tonight, with her wish not to seek publicity or celebrity remaining, she was happy to speak with me. So I went to her home for a chat. Turns out she lives around 2 miles away from me across the city. I spent around 90 minutes in her company, and she was very warm, friendly, and incredibly interesting to talk with. But I must admit, with a grandfather who used to practice magic when I was younger and someone who had taught me techniques into cold reading, mental magic and mind tricks, I was very much on my guard and on the lookout for anything I felt may be suspicious or a giveaway for techniques that could be considered less than trustworthy, shall we say. And I'll clarify this point. I have seen a number of stage psychics, mediums and fortune tellers over the years, and every last one of them has used obvious techniques associated with mind magic and manipulation. And not uncommon, a method straight from the 13 Steps by Tony Corinda. So let's just say, I was looking closely for any of this. Though, with that said, I was not there to have my fortune read, or anything corny like that. I simply wanted to ask her about the history of precognition and her time with Middleton. Christine, completely offhand and casually, confirmed a lot that I had read about her, and she shared some really amazing stories and pieces of information. Easily enough for me to fill a full episode of this show on their own. But the one thing I'm going to end tonight's episode on, the simplest thing of all that she said to me, had possibly the most impact. While talking about her past, she asked what I did for a living, what my interests were, and so on. She said that she could immediately tell that I had a scientific and analytical mind, and it was clear that I was immensely skeptical. She was right. I was, and I still am. She said that ultimately, people who want to believe the things that she tells them will do so without question. For many, it's about faith. For others, she says, for skeptics like you, well, they will never believe that what I do is genuine, and they will always look for ways to disbelieve me. This is very true. Those who wish to disprove can always rely on Occam's razor, especially in light of a phenomenon that has absolutely no hard scientific evidence to support its existence. As I stood to leave, shook her hand and thanked her for her time, she took my hand into hers and said, quote, "Your Aunt Rita and her friend Jennifer also experienced the same thing as you did when you were 11, you know. I know it had an impact on you and changed you in many ways, but Rita was unaffected and shrugged it off. Mitzi, not so much. And she was highly upset. So much so that she couldn't go and see Black Sabbath in the Capitol Theatre that night with Rita." I withdrew my hand, fairly surprised. At face value, this comment seemed like two things to me. One, a random set of information that really doesn't mean anything and could be dismissed as rubbish spoken by a fortune teller. Or two, it could have been an attempt to manipulate or convince me of her paranormal abilities. As I said, I pulled my hand away from McCarthy. She smiled back and said nothing else. She had an empathetic look on her face. But I turned and left, thanked her again, and headed to the car. I suppose now is as good a time as any to tell you that when I was 11 years old, two friends and I discovered a dead body in the woods behind my house. He was a male of around 40 years old, who had decided to end his own life by hanging from a tree. I found out from police later that he'd been hanging there for over a week. At the time, this incident had a huge impact on young me. I received therapy as the image was burned into my mind and caused me the most horrific nightmares. But I came out the other side with an intense interest in death, the dead, the process of death, and pretty much a lot of what you hear about on this show. It was absolutely the thing that happened to me when I was 11 that McCarthy was referring to. Nothing much else of interest happened that year for me. My Aunt Rita is in her 60s now. She's great. She has a wicked sense of humor and is so friendly and the most caring individual. I adore Rita more than you can imagine. So I gave her a call when I got home and told her what McCarthy had said to me. There was silence down the phone for a short while before my aunt replied, "Oh, I see, love. That's really weird, isn't it?" I paused, expecting a little more. But I said, "Yeah, it's strange and all that, but does it mean anything to you?" There was again a pause. "Come up tomorrow night, and I'll get the old photos out of the attic for us to take a look at. They might help us jog some old memories." I wasn't quite sure what she meant, but knowing her my whole life, and as well as I did, I was aware that she knew perfectly well what these comments meant. So I was really keen to head over to her house the next night. I was spooked a little bit by why she wouldn't tell me just there and then over the phone, however. But the next night I headed up to see my Aunt Rita. She lives about 30 miles away from me in a small Welsh valley town. She had already made tea and food for us both to eat, and as promised, she had her old box of family photos out on the kitchen top when I arrived. There were a few photographs already pulled out and sat in a neat pile next to the box. "Why did you even go and see a psychic?" she asked. "I didn't think you believed in any of that stuff. You were too much like your grandfather." She was right. I didn't believe in psychics, mediums, and dime store frauds that peddle this kind of manipulative shit. But I explained who McCarthy was, what her background was, and what I had been researching for this episode. My Aunt Rita is so special to me. She's an old-school hippie type. Her house is full of plants, books, incense, Buddha statues, Eastern furniture. You get the vibe. So what I told her, she took straight to heart. "Mitzi," she said, "was a nickname that I had for Jennifer, her best friend at the time. I was the only person who called her Mitzi, and it all stemmed from me being at her house when her mother called her one day. She had called her and said, 'Hey, Missy, come down here, please.' She was in trouble for leaving lots of baking utensils and trays in the kitchen and not clearing up after herself after baking cakes, I think. I thought her mother had called her Mitzi, and we laughed about my mishearing, but it stuck with me as I thought it was cute, and I called her that for a few years. But I was the only person who called her that, and I'm not sure that anyone else even knew that I had that nickname for her." This story interested me. McCarthy was trying to let me know that she was able to channel information about me and my family that could not be researched or found out, unless these abilities were genuine. I knew where this was going. My aunt went on. "In 1977, me and Mitzi had tickets to see Black Sabbath in the Capitol Theatre in Cardiff, but at the last minute, Mitzi pulled out and couldn't go, so I ended up going with Carol." That's my other aunt, her older sister. "Why couldn't Mitzi go in the end?" I asked. "Well, earlier that day, we were shopping for things to wear to the concert that night, and we saw an old man get run over by a car. It was horrible. The car hit him so far down the road, and he flailed like a rag doll until he didn't. It was obvious he was dead straight away. He was limp, blue, and laying in a pool of blood. The car must have been going about 40 to 50 miles per hour when it hit him. It hit its brakes, and there was screeching, but the loudest bang when it hit the gentleman. I thought it was awful, and I was a bit teary-eyed over it. But Mitzi, well, it really freaked her out. She was so upset. She wasn't right for months after that. That's what the woman meant when she said Mitzi and I had also experienced the same thing as you did when you were 11. I had never met Rita's friend Mitzi. She had died, my aunt said, in 1983, a few years later, from leukemia. "It was all so sad," my aunt went on, "but I haven't really spoken to anyone about her, about that car crash, or about how it affected her, since around the time that it happened, I suppose. The weight of Christine McCarthy's comments finally settled in. "She's real," my aunt said, referring to McCarthy. "She couldn't read or research about any of this stuff on the internet. You should believe her."
Thank you for taking the time to listen to our show tonight. Be sure to leave us a 5-star review on your chosen podcast platform and subscribe to our show so that you never miss an episode. Our shows aren't sponsored by any company or corporation, so any support you can give us goes a long way in supporting the work that we do. From all of us here at Dead Souls, sleep tight.